You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the November 2021 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part A. Here's the continuation of Katie Porter Has the Floor by Maximilian Potter. Porter knows what it's like for a community to be decimated by Wall Street. She grew up in Lorimore, Iowa, about 50 miles south of Des Moines, a million miles from anywhere. In the late 1970s into the 80s, the town got crushed by the farm crisis. The combination of skyrocketing interest rates and a drop in the price of commodities left many farmers saddled with debts they had no way to pay. So many of our neighbors and friends were in bankruptcy, losing everything, said Angie Simmons, Porter's friend from childhood. The Simmons farm was next to the Porter farm. Their families were like family. Our fathers were raised to provide. They were gritty, proud men standing in line for free cheese and peanut butter. What do you think that did to them? On the phone, Simmons choked up. I haven't thought about this for a while, she said. You'd go to an auction and watch our friends' parents sell off everything. There was this carnival-like auction, and then silence. It was all gone. It broke up farms and families. There were mental health breakdowns. When people didn't talk about breakdowns, many didn't come out on the other side. There were suicides. The way Liz Porter, Katie's mom, tells it, they only managed to save their farm because Katie's dad, Dan, who has a degree in economics from Iowa State, took a job at the local bank, where he found himself in a different kind of hell. Having to deny lines of credit and loans to his friends and neighbors. It was a tough time, Dan says, an audible crack in his voice. Meanwhile, the quilting club that Liz and a neighbor started blossomed into what would become a wildly successful business. Dan and Liz believed their opportunities were made possible by hard work, but education was critical. So that's how they raised their three kids, starting with their eldest. Her parents knew Katie had intellectual gifts, and largely due to Liz's advocacy, they enrolled her in a gifted program. For her junior and senior years of high school, Katie attended the prestigious Phillips Academy in Andover, Massachusetts. I remember lying in bed that first night, Porter says. Andover has a grading scheme from 0 to 6. 6 is an A+. A 5 is like an A. I remember thinking, please let me get 3s, please let me get 3s, because I didn't want to fail out. I just wanted to stay. Culturally, it was another world. The first break, when I was there, I went home with a friend. It was around Christmas. I went to this giant house. Inside, they were playing classical music. And the thing I really remember is they served fresh creamed asparagus at dinner. I was like, who lives like this? Porter didn't fail out. She graduated with honors and was accepted to Yale and then Harvard Law School. Her intention was to be a teacher, to communicate that there was more to learning than what's in textbooks. I wanted my students to learn that sometimes things happen beyond someone's control, not because of anything someone did or didn't do. And sometimes people just need help, she says. I wanted to teach because teachers changed my life. When Porter says teachers changed her life, it's a given that she's including Elizabeth Warren. The two met in the fall of 2000 when Warren taught at Harvard Law and Porter took her bankruptcy law class. Warren's class was early. Many of her students would come in, heads down, ginormous coffee cups in hand, take a seat, and try to avoid being called on. "Not Katie," Warren says. Katie was bright-eyed and ready to go, head up, watching everything going on, and ready to jump in. Warren says she called on Porter on the first day of class. In her words, Porter's response was okay, but not great. Later, Porter came to see Warren during office hours. Warren was used to students whining, "I was terrible, I get nervous, please don't call on me, I promise I'll do my work." Professor Warren had a speech prepared about how the class is rooted in the Socratic method. Much of a student's grade is based on class participation, yada yada. But Porter defied the norm. "I know I was terrible today, but don't give up on me," Warren recalls her saying. "Please keep calling on me. I am going to learn to do this." Warren was impressed. "It was her recognizing that she fell down and scraped her knees," she says, "and wanting to make sure I didn't go easy on her. She wanted me to be tough because she wanted to learn how to be tough." At Harvard, Porter spent hours in bankruptcy court, learning the machinations, but also observing how the courts and banks treated Americans in the system. Simmons, her childhood friend, visited her and once skimmed her notebooks. "I said, Katie, this has to be emotionally exhausting. Why dig into what can only make you relive the pain of your past?" She laughed it off. True to her plan, after graduating Harvard Law magna cum laude, Porter taught for a while at UNLV, then at the University of Iowa, until the University of California, Irvine, offered her a tenured position. Not long after she arrived in Orange County, Porter got a call from her mentor, Warren, then another from California Attorney General Kamala Harris. In 2012, Harris won a major victory. She extracted a settlement of about $18 billion from the nation's top banks for their predatory lending practices that caused the 2008 mortgage crisis, which devastated the economy. By the end of 2011, some 700,000 California homes were in or near foreclosure. As hard as the fight had been to get the banks to pony up, their original offer for California was $2 billion, ensuring that recipients who qualified for relief actually got it was a massive undertaking. The California settlement was part of a national framework that specified an independent monitor would make sure the banks complied. Harris decided she would also accept her own monitor. But who? She went to visit Warren at her home in Cambridge. Warren told her she needed to meet Porter. "Kamala asked me, does she have experience? Has she done this before?" Warren says, "No, but nobody does. No one has done anything like this since the Great Depression." I said, "Kamala, you need someone who can walk into a room with high-powered lawyers from banks who are billing thousands of dollars an hour and are quite sure they will be able to run circles around the person representing the families who've been screwed." Harris called Porter and shortly thereafter offered her the monitor role. Porter accepted, which on its face was insane. Porter had never run anything besides a classroom. She hadn't faced off against a single high-powered attorney, let alone an army of them. Oh, and she had zero political experience. The monitor job had three responsibilities. One, ensure the banks meet their obligations. Two, establish a monitoring system similar to that of the National Monitor. And three, immediately inform the Attorney General of any attempt by the banks to delay or dither. Initially, there were concerns about giving such a massive job to someone as inexperienced as Porter. But there was a moment when Michael Troncoso knew she was perfect for it. Troncoso served as a senior counsel to Harris, and about 2 weeks after she assumed the role, he went with Porter to her first community meeting. It was in a church basement, surrounded by housing and urban development counselors. Small nonprofit shops working in areas like South LA and Koreatown. For a year, they'd been helping homeowners, operating hand to mouth, being told they'd receive funding only to be jilted. Governor Jerry Brown had used the $300 million intended for HUD counselors to plug a budget gap. Now, there they were, in that basement with Porter, all feeling something between disappointment and fury. The meeting started with a lot of crossed arms, and Katie was one of the only white people in the room, Troncoso, who is Latino, says, and she just dazzled everybody. I don't remember what she said, but it was obvious that she really cared. By the end, people were coming up with business cards asking, how can we help? Porter remembers that meeting well. I wasn't looking down at a set of bullet points, she says. I was listening. The people we were meeting with were like, our communities are suffering. How is this not just a press release moment for the Attorney General? I think a lot of what I told them goes back to where I grew up. I have seen this before. This, don't worry, government will do something. And then they don't. They have a big press announcement. And later you're wondering, where's my money? Where is my help? I tried to explain that I was there to amplify their work. That I was there to consolidate our power as people who were collectively getting screwed by Wall Street. And that I needed them as part of the team to do that. Porter hired a staff of young attorneys and law students and turned them into an enforcement team. They sorted through hundreds of thousands of petitions from homeowners. They took in calls and data for settlement compliance. They looked out for third-party fraudsters claiming they could help homeowners get relief. Many of the people in direst need of assistance were black and brown. Frequently, it seemed, the banks could find them to foreclose, but couldn't find them to provide the relief they were entitled to. Porter and her team tracked them down, called the banks, and made sure communities got the money they were owed. Troncoso remembers Porter proving that the bank's method for sampling, which they used to show they were meeting their obligations, was flawed. He remembers the time Porter was headed to meet with a team of bank attorneys solo, and she didn't want to seem so outnumbered, so she asked a couple of interns to suit up and walk in with her. Then, he says, there's the follow-up. Katie is the master of follow-up. She outworked the banks. She just outworks everybody. It was while working for Harris, traveling around the state, being immersed in Democratic politics, that Porter started to see the 45th from a new perspective. It had long been Reagan red, but the demographics were changing. Hillary Clinton won there in 2016. And then there was the incumbent, Marion Elaine Mimi Walters. She'd won two consecutive terms, but the former investment banker had voted with Trump 99% of the time. Porter thought she could take her. She wasn't the only Democrat to think so. The primary was contentious and emotionally brutal. Someone with connections to Porter's top primary challenger tweeted about the fact that she'd once obtained a restraining order, as if it were some kind of failure. It wasn't so much the tweet itself that got to Porter. It was that the tweet was born of gossip swirling on the campaign trail. In 2013, Porter requested and was granted an emergency protective order against her then-husband, Matthew Hoffman, who physically abused her. Hoffman spent a few days in jail for domestic battery and agreed to all the demands Porter made in court. She's spoken about it in detail only once, to HuffPost, and then because she felt she had to, because her personal life was being used to undermine her desire to serve in Congress. Even after January 6th, a part of me still views that interview, having to tell that story, as the worst moment in my political career, she says. But my own decisions to protect my kids were being weaponized against me. What was I supposed to do? Withdraw from the race? I knew it would make things harder for my kids to see that again, to read it again, that it lives on the internet. Because I told the story in that context, I think my kids associate it with me being a candidate. I think that taints their view of having a political mom, and in a way that I find painful. The story has a happy ending. Porter is currently in a long-term relationship with someone she describes as a surfer. No further explanation necessary. I think I'll stick to that, she says. For real Californians, that already tells them a lot. What reveals a bit more is that during one of our interviews, Porter got a call. Her three children are Luke, 15, Paul, 13, and Betsy, 9, named for Warren. Her boys were looking for a ride home from a local Target. Porter called her surfer man, and he was happy to pick them up. Porter, of course, emerged from the primary and ran against Walters on a platform of Medicare for all, campaign finance reform, banning assault weapons, and overturning Trump's tax plan. She also ran on her work as the monitor. Nathan Click was Porter's communications advisor. He'd worked for Harris when she was attorney general and then on her Senate race. One of the biggest stories for a proof point during the Kamala campaign was the mortgage settlement, Click says. And Katie was the person who basically shouldered all of the implementation of that program. Within minutes of meeting Porter and hearing her account, he said, "That's it. Your life is your stump speech." The race was a statistical toss-up. It's a lot easier to promote progressive policy in, say, Ocasio-Cortez's solid blue district than in a district where a Democrat had never won a congressional race. It took 9 days for the race to be called, but Porter won with 52.1% of the vote. She won re-election in 2020 with 53.5%. Heading into 2022, she has an astonishing $12.9 million war chest as of June 30th, the fifth largest in the House. Perhaps in these dark and divisive times, when a mob will storm the United States Capitol and our elected leaders will lie about it and do nothing, when fights break out during a Sunday town hall in the park, when politics is so often and so obviously put before principle and people, there's reason for optimism in Porter's success. Dare it be said, a lesson. Warren thinks so. Her scholarship is always around the law fulfilling its purpose, she says of Porter. In bankruptcy law, she saw there were these amazing tools to make real change, to stop a family from falling over a cliff, tools to make sure corporations were honest and paid their fair share, to prevent banks from coming in and strong-arming everyone. It's how you can use law to make things fairer. Katie was never in it for herself. Porter's signature style has made her plenty of corporate enemies. But she's also gotten crosswise with at least one powerful member of her own party. According to a veteran member of the House Financial Services Committee, The attention Porter attracted as a newly elected member irritated Representative Maxine Waters, the committee's longtime ranking Democrat. Maxine regarded Porter as performative, said the representative, who was privy to the bad blood. But imagine you're Maxine. You've been running that committee for forever, and this freshman who asks questions in the first 5 minutes is all that gets reported. Everybody runs the clip of the freshman and nothing about you. Waters' beef played out in public. In April 2019, she convened a hearing wherein the CEOs of several of the nation's largest banks were called to testify. Among them was Jamie Dimon, chairman and CEO of J.P. Morgan Chase. The hearing room was packed. It was just a few weeks after Porter had pretty much whiteboarded Sloan out of his Wells Fargo job. Porter got down to business with Dimon. You're an expert on financial statements, and you run a $2.6 trillion bank. She removed the cap of a dry erase marker. You could literally hear it squeak off. And so, I'd like to ask for your help on a problem. Porter said she'd found a listing for a full-time job at J.P. Morgan Chase in her district that paid $16.50 an hour. At 40 hours a week, 52 weeks a year, that worked out to a salary of $35,070. She presented an equation featuring a single mom named Patricia. Patricia claims one dependent, and after taxes, is left with $29,100. Just as Porter began to write down the numbers on her whiteboard, she was interrupted by Representative Patrick McHenry, the committee's ranking Republican. McHenry had seen firsthand how effective Porter's board was. He raised an objection, a parliamentary inquiry, that it violated a rule requiring information to be shared in advance with all of the members and witnesses. Waters determined that Porter was in violation of hearing rules, the practice of making sure that all members can see what it is you're showing to the witnesses. In short, the whiteboard was too small and too low-tech. Porter opted to continue without it. Waters sided again with Republicans in September 2019 when they objected to Porter presenting a poster board she entitled Financial Services Bingo. A collection of arguments debt collectors had frequently made against regulation. Please do not raise your board, Waters said. We've talked about this before. And so it went for the next year or so. Porter navigated Waters and the rules, and she continued to dominate hearings. Then, all of a sudden, she was out. The Financial Services Committee is exclusive, meaning it must be the only committee on which a member of Congress serves in a legislative session. If a member wants to serve on multiple committees, including one that's exclusive, they must submit a waiver to the House Steering Committee. Porter did so in her first term, and it was approved. Now, according to reports, her waiver had been denied. In theory, this can happen for benign reasons. Porter had also asked to serve on and had been approved for two other committees, and the process may have been arbitrary. Practically speaking, however, ranking Democrats and leadership have wide discretion to make the committee assignments they want. Rules can be rewritten. Only just last July, Waters decided that financial services would have fewer members. According to the House member privy to the tension between Waters and Porter, the only time Maxine would side with a Republican on an objection in that committee, look, with Porter, she treats it differently, and Maxine wanted certain people off of her committee. Certain people, meaning Porter in particular. There was horse trading between her and Speaker Nancy Pelosi. It was bullshit. In what is perhaps an example of Porter Recognizing there's some bullshit she does have to tolerate, at least for now, she deftly addresses the topic. Part of what happened with financial services is Chairwoman Waters didn't ultimately rule in my favor using the whiteboard, and I was like, what? This was the thing where there were no things and now there's a thing? Come on. Beyond that, Porter says, I can't really comment. One thing I want to say about Chairwoman Waters, who I have great respect for, is that the woman keeps control of her hearings. There is no nonsense. You get to say in 5 minutes what you want to say, and then it's the next person's turn. And she has to have a lot of personal presence to do that. When I reached out to Waters Communications Director, Marcus Frias, for comment, I received an email from Veronica Morales, the Deputy Communications Director for the House Financial Services Committee, asking if I'd be willing to discuss my questions off the record with her, Frias, and the head of the committee communications team, Eric Hersey. I agreed, and before our call ended, I asked for an on-the-record response. Shortly thereafter, I received another email from Morales. Please note in your story that the chairwoman's office declined to comment on a story about another member. Here's what I'll say, McHenry told me when I asked him about Porter being dropped. As a Republican, I'm glad she is no longer there. She offered tough and smart questions and deeply understood the jurisdiction. With her gone, I have one less thing to worry about. Not long after her Irvine town hall, Porter is seated at her desk in her D.C. congressional office in the Longworth building. This is precisely where she and Ocasio-Cortez were when the Trumpian mob attacked Congress in an attempt to overturn the 2020 election, beating Capitol Police officers and hunting, in particular, for the New York congresswoman. Porter describes Alexandria knocking on the door. She was kind of rattled, Porter says. I didn't really understand at first what was happening. I knew there had been some kind of evacuation from Cannon House offices, which is where her office is, but I didn't understand. AOC sat down, and Porter offered her a glass of water. Some of Porter's staff were starstruck. Porter recalls AOC in a black floral print dress and square block heels looking at her, and she wistfully says, I knew I should have worn more comfortable shoes so I could run. One of Porter's staffers offered AOC a pair of sneakers that happened to be her size. It was cold, so Porter loaned her a puffy hooded jacket. Porter watched her pull her hair into a ponytail. At this point, we were starting to hear the noise, and the crowd was getting louder, Porter says. And she said, Now I look like a kid. Maybe they won't recognize me. I mean, that was literally our strategy. To take off as many of the trappings of office as we could and try to blend in with that crowd and run. Ocasio-Cortez recounted a similar story in an Instagram Live video. We were probably barricaded in that room together. I don't even know how many hours, she said, at Porter's office. The point of the situation was that we felt completely unsafe. That's when Porter realized the significance of the situation. If it's not safe here at that moment for a member of Congress, she recalls thinking, what part of our country is safe to do political work, to be citizens? That's the same way I felt about the town hall. If you can't have a town hall with snow cones in Irvine, the police chief reminds us Irvine is the safest city of its size 15 years in a row, where there is plenty of room for people to spread out and where there's an opportunity for everyone to participate in the same way. If you can't do that, well, then, what can you do? That's the part that really bothers me. The questions Porter raises are among the most critical at this most vexing, precarious moment in our nation's unfolding history. As Porter asked them, Speaker Pelosi and Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy are trading jabs about who will sit on the House committee to investigate the January 6th attack. Porter, of course, believes there must be accountability and that restoring safety is paramount. But, she says, I don't think most Americans give a rat's ass about that back and forth between Kevin McCarthy and Nancy Pelosi. It reinforces to them, like, who is Adam Kinzinger? What is this commission even doing? Meanwhile, what the American people would really like to know is, are we going to build any roads and bridges? Will there be child tax credits? Along with banning them from using the word impact, one of Porter's staffers says the Congresswoman makes another point around the office so often it's become something of a mantra. Buy the ticket, take the ride. Right now, the ride is pretty bumpy. There's going to be trouble, and no one knows how bad the trouble will get. But Katie Porter will continue to stride into the middle of it, believing she can make things better. the bone collector. In 2014, the FBI discovered an entire museum and thousands of human remains in the home of a 90-year-old Indiana man who hosted the Boy Scouts and claimed to have detonated the first atomic bomb. Was he a pillar of his community or the most prolific grave robber in modern American history? By Josh Sanborn, with illustrations by Leonardo Santamaria. Opening illustration, Don Miller collected more than 40,000 artifacts over six decades, the largest private stockpile the FBI has ever uncovered. And the illustration shows shelves of very organized artifacts. The carpenter dreams of places he's never been. He'll find himself somewhere deep in China, gazing at a Buddhist temple, posing as if he's being photographed. Or sometimes he's on Easter Island, near its carved human figures with oversized heads, outside centuries-old burial caves, almost like he's unearthing something. Then he wakes and realizes none of it was real. He's never visited China, nor seen Easter Island. His dreams are someone else's trips and memories that exist in weathered photos and grainy films, strung together in his mind like a phantom reel, images he's looked at so many times, too many, that they've invaded his psyche. One evening, years earlier, in October 2013, Carpenter, an FBI agent, heard his phone ringing at his home in Indianapolis. His supervisor was calling to tell him of an anonymous tip about a man in rural Indiana named Don Miller. The tipster said Miller was an amateur archaeologist who'd amassed a vast collection of artifacts, especially Native American items. Inside his home, the person claimed, were skulls, bones, and entire skeletons. At the time, Carpenter was one of a handful of agents working for the FBI's art theft program, typically known for investigating fine art. Stolen Renoirs, lifted Rembrandts, fakes and forgeries, heist, famous and not so famous. He admits that agents who are aware the unit even exists think they're just the guys who chase down Van Goghs. But the program investigates all kinds of cultural property crimes, including something as unusual as potential human remains inside a Midwestern home. Carpenter reached out to the tipster. They talked for an hour. The person who'd seen the collection kept referring to it as huge. For Carpenter, who'd worked art crimes for 5 years, including private collection cases, a large collection would have meant 100 items. So, what's huge? 200 items? 400? No, man, a lot more than that, he told Carpenter. I think it's about 200,000 pieces. Carpenter's initial reaction was to dismiss it. Not possible. Either this person is a crackpot or has wildly overshot. Nobody has 200,000 of anything, Carpenter told me. Hell, most large state museums don't have 200,000 pieces. So Carpenter pressed him. It can't be that many. Just trust me, the person told him. This stuff is everywhere. Next photo, or illustration rather, an anonymous tip led Agent Tim Carpenter of the FBI's art theft program to investigate. He couldn't believe what he found inside. The tipster said Miller had acknowledged that some of the items in his collection were illegal, and that over the course of six decades, Miller had dug much of it up himself. He said Miller had a bomb shelter and underground tunnels on his property, and put Carpenter in touch with someone else who'd seen the collection and taken photos. Carpenter saw them. There were skulls and bones. They were unmistakable. At the Indianapolis field office, Carpenter ran Miller's name through the FBI's databases. and discovered he'd been in touch with the agency 5 years earlier. In 2008, agents had received a tip that Miller had two spheres that looked like pits, the cores of nuclear weapons. When the FBI, along with Department of Energy officials, visited Miller's home, they didn't find pits, but discovered a chunk of depleted uranium and a large bar of graphite Miller claimed was from the U.S.'s first nuclear reactor. Carpenter says the DOE seized the uranium, which he described as not something you'd want to handle, but left the graphite after deeming it inert and harmless. But clearly, agents had been in Miller's house. They'd seen the collection. It was documented in some paperwork in the past as a passing note, like, oh, by the way, he had this really cool collection of Native American stuff, Carpenter said. But the agents weren't cultural property experts. They didn't know what they were looking at. Carpenter decided he needed to see the artifacts for himself and thought up a way in. He would tag along on a follow-up visit with one of the agents who'd been to Miller's house before. A bit of a ruse, Carpenter told me. On November 1st, the two agents drove an hour south past farms and cornfields to Moscow, a tiny, unincorporated township in Rush County. They pulled into Miller's driveway. Just past its curve sat a large two-story beige stone home. An old white farmhouse stood out back. Large antennas in the yard poked at the sky. Nearby sat multiple barns, outbuildings, garages. The agents, casually dressed, approached the front door and noticed a statue, a Chinese terracotta warrior, life-size, standing guard. Miller opened the door. He was tall, thin, elderly, happy, eager even, to invite them in. He seemed thrilled to have someone to talk to. Inside, his house was cluttered. Miller guided them through, talking about himself, his life, and his collection, and soon led them down a stairwell. As Carpenter descended, the room below felt as if it was expanding with each step, like a camera aperture widening and widening until he finally reached the bottom. I just stopped, Carpenter said. I stood there and looked around like, you have got to be shitting me. Stretched out before him, arranged on row after row of collapsible tables, inside glass cases, hand-labeled and lighted, Carpenter saw a wall-to-wall, floor-to-ceiling private museum. One man's life's work on exhibit. Over here, 2,500-year-old Chinese jewelry. There, an Egyptian sarcophagus. Here, a dugout canoe that traveled the Amazon River. There, dinosaur eggs, a Tibetan cowbell, a fossilized crocodile skull, pre-Columbian weapons, Ming Dynasty vases, shrunken heads, Nazi helmets, Aztec figurines, Celtic axes. In that brief, spiraling moment, Carpenter estimated 10,000 artifacts. Then he realized he was only seeing half the room. The rest was behind the stairwell, and remembered the multiple buildings surrounding Miller's home. It was a gut-wrenching butterfly in the stomach, oh my God, I think my life has just changed kind of moment, Carpenter said. They spent a couple of hours going around the room, Miller describing how he used metal detectors on battlefields and Native American reservations, telling them how he'd personally dug up each artifact. Carpenter, trying to take it all in, looking for the bones and skulls he'd seen in photos. Miller's wife, Sandra, coming down to offer them tea. Carpenter saw things that were almost certainly illegal. Pre-Columbian artifacts protected by treaty. Chinese items that fell under the country's wide-reaching patrimony laws. It all started, Miller told them, in New Mexico in the 1940s. When he worked at the Los Alamos National Laboratory on the Manhattan Project for J. Robert Oppenheimer himself, the father of the atomic bomb. In one of the glass cases, Miller showed Carpenter a photo of an orange mushroom cloud. Nearby sat a radio system Miller said sent the signal to detonate the very first nuclear device, Trinity. Don claimed to have been the guy who fired the first atomic bomb, Carpenter said. Miller told them he was so close to the explosion that he ran and hid in a bunker before the blast wave hit. But when he wasn't working on the most profound scientific project of the 20th century, he combed the base for arrowheads. After a couple of hours, the agents thanked Miller for having them over and drove back to Indianapolis. Carpenter knew that private collectors typically display about half their collection and keep the rest in storage. Leaving Miller's house that day, Carpenter, a Tennessee native who refers to his guesstimates as Kentucky windage, estimated 20,000 objects on display, putting Miller's full collection around 40,000, less than the tipster's estimate, but still the single largest private collection Carpenter or the FBI had ever come across. Carpenter doubted everything was illegal, but it was possible the agency would have to seize it all. And how exactly do you seize 40,000 priceless artifacts? But something else puzzled him. Carpenter had expected to find human remains, the bones and skulls he'd seen in the photos. The only bones he saw were a femur buried on a shelf and part of a skull cap sitting upside down like a shallow bowl. Miller told him the skull was from a Native American who died at Wounded Knee, where up to 300 Lakota were massacred by the army in 1890. He showed them the bullet, a small ball lodged in the skull. But that wasn't in the photos. The bones weren't there. Next illustrations. Miller was always eager to show off his collection, but some objects he kept hidden. His basement museum included display cases packed with Chinese jewelry, dinosaur eggs, shrunken heads, Nazi helmets, Aztec figurines, Celtic axes, and more. Frank Densler was barely a teenager when his Boy Scout troop visited Miller's home in the late 1960s. Miller, dressed in plaid and blue jeans, loved showing the kids around, always polite, never a braggart. He didn't have kids of his own. He had his collection. Knowing Don, I would say he was probably afraid that if somebody didn't save these items, they'd be dug up, burned, built over, Densler said. Something would happen to them, and nobody would ever know. Next illustrations. Miller claimed to have fired the first atomic bomb, Trinity. And the FBI seized a stack of passports with stamps from Cambodia to Canada, Iraq to Peru, but found no evidence of permits allowing digs. Miller was well known throughout his community, living almost his entire life in Rush County. He was born in 1923 and grew up in the white farmhouse behind his home. During World War II, he attended Ohio State University's Army Specialized Training Program, a partnership with the military that trained students in fields helpful to the war effort. Miller studied engineering, then got shipped off to New Mexico. Over the years, Miller often talked about his time there to friends and even journalists. He told a reporter for the Rushville Republican that Oppenheimer, whom he called Oppie, picked him to head the test bomb's firing squad and claimed to the Indianapolis Star that he gave the signal to begin the countdown to the Trinity explosion. After the war, Miller married his high school sweetheart, Sue, and received bachelor's and master's degrees in electrical engineering from the University of Illinois, graduating in the top 3% of his class, and a doctorate from Purdue University. In the early 1950s, he began working at a naval ordnance plant in Indianapolis, later named Naval Avionics, and started traveling extensively. Back home, Miller was often at the corner restaurant in nearby Rushville, drinking coffee and eating pie. If somebody wanted to see his latest finds, he'd tell them to come on over. People knew about the collection and his travels as a Christian missionary that also seemed to serve as archaeological digs. He would go on these mission trips and uncover something, find something, and maybe stick it in his backpack, Densler said. I don't think anybody thought that he was stealing the stuff. After seeing Miller's collection, Carpenter started reaching out to everyone he could think of, anthropologist, archaeologist, the U.S. Attorney's Office, the Department of Justice. He researched the legal knot of treaties, foreign patrimony laws, state and federal restrictions, some more than 100 years old, that might apply. He was about to take on the biggest case of his career only a year after arriving in Indianapolis. When he was growing up outside Knoxville, Carpenter didn't imagine he'd be tracking down lost artifacts and artwork. If anything, he saw himself becoming an artist. But he got sidelined by Desert Storm when he became a bomb technician for the Air Force. In 2004, he joined the FBI, investigating terrorism cases before getting burned out and requesting a transfer to criminal work. A couple of art cases came his way, and by 2008, a spot opened up on the Small Art Theft Program. Carpenter was its eighth member. Over the years, the program has recovered a 300-year-old Stradivarius violin, ruby slippers from The Wizard of Oz, Cezanne's and Monet's worth millions, alongside sculptures, memorabilia, coins, and books, more than 20,000 items worth $900 million since 2004. But the FBI had never run across anything like Miller's basement. Carpenter decided he needed to see the collection again. This time he showed up unannounced and asked more pointed questions. Miller told him about a Native American effigy pot his first wife, Sue, unearthed in the Southwest, a carronade from a Gulf of Mexico shipwreck he'd obtained after hiring a local diver to haul it up, a pair of mastodon tusks from Canada he'd excavated on a road trip. You just went and pulled off the side of the road and went into somebody else's land and dug these up? Carpenter asked him. Oh, yeah, Miller said. He strapped them to his car roof and drove them over the border. Next, illustrations. Miller told a friend, if you can divert security on one item, you can get something else by them, something better. He baited them. And Miller said that he dug up each artifact personally. Miller said he and Sue, who died in 2000, often took long trips together in the summer, stopping at archaeological sites along the way. They dig, load up their truck, then drive it all back home. He said he usually found artifacts two ways, by talking to the locals or using ham radio. In the 1970s and 80s, Rick Bolt worked with Miller at Naval Avionics. In the mornings, Bolt remembers that he would see Miller sitting in his car, a dirty, utilitarian, metallic blue 1974 Chevrolet Malibu, engine running, the car plastered with antennas. He'd be carrying on ham radio conversations with somebody in Southeast Asia or South America, Bolt said. He didn't listen to the radio. He talked on it. Miller got his ham radio license in 1943, founded his own electronics company called Wyman Research, and helped develop SlowScan TV, a technology that transmits still images across high-frequency radio bands. In 1972, he was honored as Amateur of the Year by a ham radio convention and later helped get SSTV aboard the Mir space station, building the system that beamed back images of Earth in December 1998. Bolt remembers Miller as a walking, talking encyclopedia, fond of green-checked sport jackets and a giant ceramic coffee cup emblazoned with a Navy seal. At lunch, they talk about how societies evolved, history, civilizations, or Miller's own expeditions. Miller often took a couple weeks vacation each year to go on a dig, Bolt says. One time, Miller told Bolt that he drove to Mexico with his wife and asked the locals about nearby ruins. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selection by Mark Hoffman.